Hi and welcome to CDH Conversations. I'm Nadeem Mohammed, director in the employment law practice. In commemoration of Women's Month, CDH is proud to bring you a special series of episodes dedicated to women's empowerment. At CDH, we believe that the issues affecting women deserve attention and recognition throughout the year. Today, we are joined by Asma Kachalia, who is a director in our employment law practice. We will be discussing legal protections for LGBTQ plus women in the workplace. But before that, first, Asma, please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, Nadeem. So as you mentioned, I'm a director in the employment law practice area at CDH. I have experience in a large array of employment law related matters, from individual labor law to collective labor law, including, and for purposes of this podcast, disputes about discrimination and harassment as well. We obviously know that a lot of significant legal challenges for LGBTQIA plus women, and a lot of that needs to be dealt with within the employment sphere as well.
Definitely. So maybe let's start with a question that deals with the legal challenges that LGBTQ women face. So in your view, Asma, what are the most significant legal challenges LGBTQ plus women face in the workplace? And how can existing anti-discrimination laws be strengthened or expanded to address these specific issues?
So in many ways, South Africa could be considered a leader on the continent in terms of protections and equal treatment for LGBTQIA plus people. Our constitution, as everybody knows, clearly prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender and sexual orientation. And we know Employment Equity and our Employment Equity Act prohibits unfair discrimination in the workplace that's based on sexual orientation and gender, obviously, amongst a lot of other things. We also have what was introduced recently, the Harassment Code, which defines sexual harassment as including harassment on the basis of sexual orientation. So in practice, much of the discrimination that LGBTQIA plus women face is compounded because they experience both gender discrimination and also marginalization based on their sexual orientation. And it's not uncommon, as we all know, as a general rule globally, for LGBTQIA plus women to be vulnerable to increased violence and harassment. I mean, these kinds of attacks happen in the form of verbal harassment to bouts of serious physical violence that result in murder sometimes. And many efforts have been made both legislatively and culturally to prevent these kind of things from happening. So it's not so much an issue about inadequate legal protections in South Africa or in the South African context in particular, but rather awareness of these protections and our constitutional ethos of equality and the effective implementation of these in the workplace as well as in other spaces. Discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation for all LGBTQIA plus people, particularly women, can be eliminated or at least reduced in this way. But looking more closely at legal protections, I think factors such as race, socioeconomic status, and gender identity impact the effectiveness of legal protections for these women in the workplace in particular. And maybe a question from that is, what in your view, Nadeem, are the kinds of legal strategies that can be employed to address these sort of complexities?
So I do think it's important to recognize intersectionality in this regard. So firstly, the legal position is clear in terms of what constitutes discrimination, but there is a lack of awareness on how multiple forms of marginalization intersect to create particularly unfortunate circumstances for many people, including and sometimes specifically women. Women of color and women who are impoverished, women of color who are impoverished or who are socially and financially marginalized, tend to suffer much more and are much more vulnerable. And then we also have the situation of trans women who often have a far more difficult time in being understood and accepted, generally as a case, but specifically also our purposes here in the workplace, even when it comes to everyday practices such as showing up or having preferred pronouns or name changes or the way they elect to dress. Employers need to be much more cognizant and aware of these intersections and alive to the impact that their policies and their prejudices of people who work in their workplace can have on the well-being and exclusion of all women who fall under the category of LGBTQ+, or women who identify in a way that does not align or accord with heterosexual norms. But I want to also come back to the legal position here in terms of, you spoke a bit about the legislation, you spoke about the constitution, you spoke about the Employment Act, Equity Act, you spoke about the harassment code. What role do you think legal precedents and judgments of our courts play in shaping the current landscape of workplace protections for LGBTQ plus women? And are there any recent cases that impact the future well-being and rights and protections that LGBTQ plus women are entitled to?
So there are a number of judgments that have paved the way for greater recognition of the LGBTQIA plus rights in terms of privacy, marriage equality, and other benefits that we know were ordinarily available to heterosexual couples. But now through these, you know, it's now moved on to protection of LGBTQIA plus women and others who fall within that category. And I mean, I could go through those judgments, but to name just some significant ones, there's Detoy and another versus Minister of Welfare, which first dealt with the rights of same-sex partners to jointly adopt children. There's September and Subramuni, which I think you mentioned transgender woman. She was a transgender woman, September, incarcerated in a men's prison. And she obviously brought an application against Subramuni, who was a head of correctional facility at the time, to express her gender identity while in prison based on her right to human dignity and equality. There was Zibatini, which dealt with corrective rape. I think when we started, we mentioned the kinds of sort of violence that these women are faced with. And this dealt with corrective rape as late as 2019, if I'm not mistaken. So within the rural areas, that was still something that was being done. We obviously have KOS versus Minister of Home Affairs, which dealt with the situation where transgender individuals who were married under the Marriage Act, which provides for marriage being a union between a man and a woman, applied to Home Affairs to alter their sex description of their identity documents. There was Nandutu and others versus Minister of Home Affairs, which looked at South African citizen in a permanent same-sex partnership who were to approach the court to have Regulation 9, 9A of the immigration regulations declared unconstitutional because it limited their right to dignity. There's a lot that have paved that way. And obviously we have Caster Semenya's case, which was probably one that most people remember. But specifically in the workplace, both the legislature and this year, the courts have provided increased parental leave for same-sex couples, which affects LGBTQIA plus women. And obviously, the most important case was the one at the end of 2023, as we know, which was Van Wyk and others versus Minister of Employment, where the court declared the relevant provisions of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act and the Unemployment Insurance Act invalid, given that they're inconsistent with the fundamental rights to equality and dignity. I mean, specifically, if you look at parental leave, in particular in the past, it was always given to a woman. And why it was raised here is that, or why the fundamental rights of equality and dignity are inconsistent, is because they seem to unfairly discriminate between mothers and fathers. They unfairly discriminate between one set of parents and another based on whether their children were born of the mother, were adopted, or conceived by surrogacy. And all of these points collectively would speak to areas that the LGBTQIA plus women are particularly faced with. Now, in terms of this judgment, where this will ultimately land is yet to be seen when the matter is decided by the Constitutional Court. Our courts have also come out clearly in respect of prohibiting discrimination by employers because of a person's sexual orientation or gender identity. But I think, and I mentioned all these court cases, I think what's important is that us as legal professionals work with organizations to ensure that, you know, there are policies and practices that not only comply with anti-discrimination laws, but also actively promote an inclusive and supportive environment for these kind of women. And what are some ways, in your view, Nadeem, maybe that we could achieve this as legal professionals?
So I think the issue is rather a simple one, even though it may at times not be easy to accomplish. But employment lawyers, for example, in relation to their clients' businesses, employment lawyers can be effective by advising employers of their obligations in creating and maintaining a safe working environment that is free from harassment and discrimination. And to foster a more sustainable change would require commitment to the humanity of all people, irrespective of their identity. But in addition to this, for our own workspaces as lawyers, in our own firms and in our own practices, it's one thing when we furnish advice to a client to say, this is what you need to comply with. These are your obligations. These are type of protections that you have to implement to ensure that people who are part of sexual or gender minorities need to have to feel included. But in our own firm, sometimes it can be a bit laxed on this, and we're not as critically self-aware of how it may show up. And we need to implement some of the same policies and advice that we usually furnish to our clients in this regard. To continue the point, I wanted to ask you, Asma, what do you think some of the key legal considerations for employers when implementing training programs and creating reporting mechanisms to ensure they effectively protect women in general, but specifically LGBTQ plus women from harassment and discrimination in the workplace?
I think you made a good point. And I think in so far as possible, employers must firstly ensure that they have LGBTQIA plus representation when they make decisions in this regard, including them at the outset, sort of gets rid of a whole lot of issues that, you know, can be avoided later on. Employers must review their policies to identify any bias or inequality in treatment based on gender and sexual orientation. And they need to remedy these by amending their policies. So I think revisiting your policies, but not only doing it once or twice, doing it quite often and making sure that any of these sort of issues are remedied is quite important. And when incident of discrimination or harassment is actually reported by someone, an employer must take it seriously. It can't just be a tick box approach. It must be taken seriously, and there must be immediate action to eradicate the discrimination or harassment. And I think once employers do this and take these sort of clear actions, you know, they at least their duty to their employees in general, but also their duty to their LGBTQIA plus woman employees in general, you know, will be held because they still have that duty. And, you know, they can ensure that they feel safe within the workplace, which I think is very important.
Thanks so much, Asma, for this discussion. I think there's a lot of key takeaways for both our own industry and our own sector, as well as for other workspaces, clients and people in other sectors in relation to how we can improve safety, security, inclusion and representation of LGBTQ plus people, especially of women.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.